Kaplan at the Island Institute today. We're interviewing Ted for the shoe workers and the industry. This is part of the oral history project. We are interviewing Ted on November 27th. I'm Rachel DeGrozier, who will be doing the interviewing along with Roger Natto, who used to work for Ted at Falcon Shoe. Ted, could you start by stating your full name and spelling it so we have it correct?
Do you mean the official, the Theodore, you mean that? Theodore
Johansson? Exactly
Johansson.
The way you are,
okay.
Or how?
T-H-E-O-D-O-R-E, Cortland, C-O-U-R-T-L-A-N-D, Johansson, J-O-H-A-N-S-O-N.
Good. Where were you born?
I was born in Lynn, Massachusetts. Lynn was actually a shoe town. That's why I got in the business.
Oh, okay, good. That's interesting. And when did you decide to move to Lewiston?
Well, that was, we started in 1963 was, I think, when the factory started. And I had got out of college. I was an engineer, graduate engineer, and went to work for a shoe factory, which was my family's business back in Massachusetts. And I had done a study for them, and it was obvious they weren't going to survive in Massachusetts in my mind. And so I had done a study for them of places that they could move their factory. And I came up with three places, and they turned them all down. And then it finally dawned on me that my father and his two brothers, who basically owned the business, they didn't want to leave Massachusetts. And they were, at that time, they were 60 years old. And why should they leave? So I realized that if I stayed there, that business was going down. And so I looked to set up a factory of my own. And I had one of the brothers, which was the president of the company, my uncle, he said, I'll get five investors together who put up $5,000, and you can go put up your factory. I didn't have a nickel. And so then, in my travels of looking at a place for them, I had found Lewiston Auburn, which was not one I had offered them, because they had capital and could set up a factory somewhere else. So we had looked at other communities, but I knew of Lewiston Auburn. And there was high unemployment, there was like 11%. There were high unemployment among skilled shoe workers, which was important in my mind. And there were empty buildings because the textiles were leaving. And so there was tons of space that could be rented for pretty much nothing. There was an infrastructure there for the shoe industry in Lewiston Auburn. United Shoe Machinery had an office there. They kept supplies there. There were all kinds of shoe suppliers in that area. So it was a perfect place for somebody who didn't have a gosh darn nickel to get started. And so that was the place that I figured would be the best, you know, for me.
What was the community like when you first established in Lewiston Auburn?
It was definitely I would say that the Franco-American heritage was still strong, very strong. Because I can remember one of the things, I lived at a motel called the Masonette, which was downtown.
And, you.
Yeah, okay. But that was got to be not to my taste. I ended up living at the YMCA over in Auburn, because it was, I think, $9 a week or something like that. And so that's where I ended up living for the first 6 months. But anyway, I mean, it was interesting to me that downtown, you know, still you saw teenagers talking French to each other. Okay. That indicated to me that heritage was strong and that it was still there. And I would have to say in the time that we were there, and factory was there. You lost that. You know, we really lost that. We lost that heritage. But there was a, that was the main, and downtown, you know, it was really the center of that French culture. It really was, and I loved it. It was terrific. But anyway, that was the major difference. And the other thing was there was unemployment, tremendous unemployment in Lewiston at that time. I was 10 or 11 percent. That was probably the best decision we ever made. I mean, because the people really did want to work. You know, that was the one thing that Lewiston often had.
And the French culture, a hard-working
culture. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was really great. You know, we even had tryouts for our job when we started. Yeah, I mean, there were that many unemployed people that you could put in tryouts for very specific trades, like a bedlaster. We're having bedlaster tryouts at 10 o'clock. And you might have five or six people come in and try out to be a bedlaster.
That's how you opened up. I know that it was in 63, and I didn't get there till 69 myself.
Yeah, right.
But I did.
The thing was, I had some ideas, and they were unique for the shoe industry. And basically, one was a kind of a conveyor operation. And when people would come in to try out, there was always people who didn't like change, and people would say, "Well, that'll never work." Okay. Next. Because you had four or five people to choose from. And there was no sense choosing somebody who didn't have faith that what you had was not going to give it a try, if you know what I'm saying. And that was only possible because there was just tremendous unemployment. It really was. You know, most people wanted to work.
So when you started, what were some of the major challenges that you faced if it was easy to get the workers?
Well, of course, you know, the big challenge, of course, you got to get the customers, okay? And I had an old salesman that I had, in the old days, he had worked for my father and uncles, and then he had broken off and set up his own company with five other partners back in Pennsylvania or something. But they were a typical, I call it a Brooklyn partnership, you know, and one would leave every day, and a new partner would come in every day, and they were always fighting and all this kind of it. And finally, Aaron, his name was Aaron Potashnik, and Aaron finally left them. And I think they went broke, if I'm not mistaken, I don't know. And so Aaron, I teamed up with Aaron. He was my salesman when I started. And, you know, getting the customers was very important. You're brand new, who's going to give you the business. And we were lucky, I mean, to be honest with you. He had the stature to get the first orders from people, but then the product had to speak for itself. And we really worked hard to make a very quality product. And the people liked the product, and we went from there. But you needed an Aaron to get us in the door of those customers. And then once we were in the door, the product, good and was inexpensive. Our process was always, our philosophy was always to have the most modern techniques that we can use. Because when I started with a fellow, Bruce Hanley, who was my vice president of manufacturing, and we were both engineers. And so we saw the shoe industry for what it was. It had an awful lot of handwork. And technology was just coming into the shoe industry. And of course it was, you know, most people, they really don't like change. And so it's very difficult to bring new technology into anything. And that was Bruce and I's forte, was to bring technology into the industry. And therefore our costs were a lot lower than anybody else's, and we grew pretty rapidly.
Your workforce, mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit about them? You mentioned something about a lot. It was easy to get into the, you know, as far as you didn't need an education and so forth. Was it a good workforce? Did you have to?
Yeah, one of the things about the shoe industry is that the jobs are, they're skilled jobs. And it takes, and in many cases, it takes a long time to really learn the jobs and learn the machinery. And learn how to do it right. One of the things that I think that we've had people from other industries who come and view the factory, and what they always never really understood, but when they, until they saw it, was that when you're working with shoes, basically you're working on a natural product, which is leather. And leather is nothing more than the hide of an animal, which is just like our skin. And every part of that leather is different. It stretches differently one way from another, whether it, and it's softer if it comes from your belly. Do you want shoes made out of my belly, or you want them made out of my back? Well, you want them made out of my back because it's firmer, you know? And so the leather, whether it's out of the armpit of the animal, or the stomach of the animal, or even the back, certain parts of it, is all different. Well, when you're making, using that product, then each piece that you're working with is different. And to automate that, that's the reason why it was one of the last industries that was ever automated, was, wow, this stuff is tough to work with. And so that's what took the skill and the time, was that, you know, over time you would slowly work with different materials and know how to handle them and solve those problems as you're working with it. So that's why it wasn't a rote job of learning something. You know, it really took experience. That was the thing, it took experience. And so that's what a lot of those people had. And because the industry was basically a piecework industry, which means that they get paid by each piece they did, that there were certain people who not only had the experience and had the skill, but then had the speed. And those people did quite well. I mean, that was the problem with some of our supervisors, was making sure that our supervisors had greater salaries than the people who worked for them, because some of those people really could make some money, if you remember that in those days, right? Yeah. I think that was it. And so it wasn't the education, it was the experience that counted. Later on, as we progressed and as the industry changed, then all of a sudden education now started to be important. Because what happened was we started to use technology and computers, and our machinery got more complex, and the people who had to run them had to know more. And the thing that happened was we would make a particular shoe. In the old days, you might make 20,000 pair of this particular shoe. Well, everybody knew how to make that shoe because you made 20,000 pair of them. You made them all the time. And as foreign competition came in, and the large orders went overseas, and we were left with the smaller and smaller volumes of how to make these things. So therefore, they didn't have many, many pairs to work with. You had very few pairs. And so we had to actually make a construction sheet. And there, as far as steps in making, especially the more complex boots we ended up with, there could be over a hundred different steps in making that product. And they might be a different 100 from another shoe or another one. And they might be, some operations might never be performed on one, but they are on another. They might be in a different sequence. All of that had to be all explained and all that. So all of a sudden now you have people who now have to be able to read English. They have to be able to read well. They have to be able to understand. A lot of those jobs are run by computers. They had to be able to operate computers. So all of a sudden it changed. And we found that we ended up giving them their education. Roger was a big part of that in starting that process of getting people to go back to school, getting their high school diplomas, and then moving on with other subjects and other courses. I think were we the first, Roger, to do
non-site. There was Geiger Brothers that had done that with their employees, continued education, education program in the workplace. And so we hired, we contracted with Lewiston Adult Education, and they came in-house to do the classes. So the employees who want to participate to upgrade, to go for their GED, basically.
Right. Yeah.
And that worked well for us.
It really worked well.
Can you comment? You had started at the beginning, you mentioned something about that you were trying to figure out why the Rumford kids and the dropout rates and all that. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, it goes back to that, you see, that education portion. In it's funny, we did have a group of teachers who came in, and at that time, I think the superintendent in Lewiston wanted some of the teachers to see the jobs in the city so they could understand where these children that they were teaching were going to end up. And we had a great discussion about education, and they were concerned about, in Lewiston, they had a high dropout rate. And we talked about the difference between Lewiston and, say, Rumford, because they both had the French heritage, and the same people immigrated from Canada to Rumford as to Lewiston. Why this difference? And I guess at the time, what we felt was that the mills in Rumford, the paper mills, they just plain required a high school diploma that you wouldn't even be considered for a job. And those were the good jobs in Rumford. So every kid in high school knew he had to have the diploma in order to get that job. So that was why he stayed. And it was different with us because, unfortunately, because of piecework and the skills and some of the experience, people could be in the industry and they could end up making very good money. Well, if your parents made good money and they didn't have a high school education, you know, all of a sudden you're getting pretty itchy at 16 and 17 years old and want the money. What the devil? You know, they're doing it, why can't I? And so I really think that was one of the unfortunate things about Lewis and Auburn, and the unfortunate thing about both the textile industry and the shoe industry, was that you could get there and through experience end up making money and raise your family and all that, no problem. But I don't think that it set the right message to the kids. And I feel strongly about that.
Do you think that is still happening somewhat today, the way kids
can get on
a job with high salaries? And
you know, I don't know. I you know, because I'm not in tune with that. I do know that later on, when we ended up really taking over starting a mold company where we ended up with machinists and mold makers and all that kind of thing as part of our business. It's kind of a separate company, but we owned it. And then finally the fellows who ran it, we let them take it over. But the problem with that company was trying to get kids in high school to want to go on and take machinist courses and things like that. And those were good jobs. They were good paying jobs. But even at that time, and that was in the later years of our factory, boy, it was tough to get those kids to go do that. You know, at that particular time, they just didn't seem to have see the vision out there 2 years or 3 years from now.
Yeah.
You know.
Were most of your workers French Canadian?
Oh yeah.
Or did you?
Yeah,
so most of them were.
No, most were French Canadian. Yeah, absolutely.
Because like in the textile.
50% of, I don't know, as I say, I think well over 50% of the kids at the time, I think, spoke French easy, you know. And as I say, that over time, over the 30, 35 years that we were there, I saw that decrease, you know, that you didn't see the teenagers being able to speak French anymore. When we started, the teenagers were able to speak French, and they did. You'd see two teenagers on the street, and you'd see them speaking French to each other.
Did you find that as the years went by, that different other ethnic groups would come in, so that it changed the composition of your work staff, or?
I don't think at that time we didn't have any one big group come in, such as what's happened in Lewiston Auburn lately. But I don't think it was any one ethnic group that came in after that. Was more a mixed American group, I'd have to say. Or
so they all
second or third generations by that time, and who knows what we have.
So there was no major conflict between the workers and so forth as far
no,
as
I don't
it
think
was
so.
A good workforce?
Yeah, no,
yeah.
No, not at all.
Okay. Did you find that your workers worked their day and then went home and did their thing, or did they tend to socialize as friends outside of the, or do you have any idea
about
that?
You know, I really don't know about that. As to whether they had the same groups outside the factory that they had inside the factory, I don't know. They had their groups inside the factory. That's for darn sure. Yeah.
Okay. What do you mean What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean there were people who would always kind of they'd always have lunch together. You know, in those days, Rachel, of course, you know, we had smoking, and you know, you allowed smoking back in those days. So you know, there'd be a group that would always go to the smoking room together. You know, and well, maybe it was the smokers. I don't know. But remember, we would have smoking rooms. Remember that, right? You know,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they would go, and then the other people at lunch breaks would kind of find their own little groups, and you could always see the same people together, you know, and those
which
things.
Is almost
yeah.
natural.
Yeah, which is natural, right?
Natural.
Absolutely. Yeah,
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 absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
How did they get to get their jobs? Like, it seems like I went with Roger, and mm-hmm. there are so many. Which amazed me, mm-hmm. so many steps to making a shoe.
Right. That's.
I said, I guess I'll never complain
yeah.
about buying a
yeah,
shoe
right,
again.
Yeah, right.
But how did they come to get the jobs that they got?
At the very beginning, as I said, we had people and we had tryouts for the jobs. I mean, because those skills already existed. And then after that, of course, then we had to bring them along and train them.
So we had to have special training.
Ourselves. And,
yeah.
And that was, it was difficult. That means you had to have, you know, an extra machine to be able to train that person on. But in our case, we had it. I mean, because we had started with a different concept, which was a kind of a conveyor line, you can't stop the line. If you've got a machine that goes down, you're in deep trouble. So we had probably more spare machinery than was truly present in the shoe industry as an average at that particular time. Well, now having that extra machine also allowed you the opportunity to train somebody. So it was kind of a back way thing that allowed us to do some training that maybe the other factories weren't able to do, you know, at that time.
Yeah.
But we had to have it for a different reason.
Yeah.
But now once it's there, you know, extra $50,000 for a piece of machine. Those machines are expensive. All those little machines you saw there, if you've been through the factory, they're not cheap.
Yeah, no.
And one of the things you have to understand that the shoe industry, back in the early years, okay, United Shoe Machinery was declared a monopoly in, I think, 1950. And I ended up doing a study of this United Shoe case because they were declared a monopoly. Prior to that, what they did was they would only rent machinery. They would not sell it. And when they rented it, they also rented it with maintenance. So you did have to pay for the parts, but the maintenance was free. So therefore, anybody could start a shoe factory. Not anybody, but anybody could financially. You didn't have to have the capital because all of this machinery you could rent. Not only could you rent it, but it didn't make any difference how big you were because there wasn't any economy of scale of being able to buy the equipment and end up with an advantage, an economic advantage over somebody who was only renting.
Right.
Okay? So that even though United Shoe created a monopoly in the shoe machinery industry by doing that, it created competition in the shoe industry. And what it was United Shoe was declared a monopoly in the early, well, mid-50s, I think maybe 55, it was 55, 56. So that's what changed in the shoe industry, which United Shoe was declared a monopoly. Now they had to sell the machinery. Now, what that changed was that if they had a particular piece of equipment that did the job and they're charging rent for it, why should they go out and invent a new machine that will do that better and faster? Because all they're going to do is replace their own machines. So once they were declared a monopoly, all of a sudden, new machines started to be developed. developed for the shoe industry. Not only United Shoe Machinery, but other machine companies, International Lawler, started to come up with, because now people would, now they had an opportunity to sell their machines, okay, into the industry. Okay. That's what was happening, just happened, as I got into the industry and as Bruce and I came as engineers. That's why when I say we were bringing technology, the industry had not seen many new machines in all of those years. Okay.
So that was an open door for you.
So it was an open door for us, and we did, and we stepped into that, and we bought all the new technology. We had all of the new technological machines. We built, we forged a relationship with United Shoe Machinery, and when they had to test a machine, they set it up. Do you remember we had some rooms?
Yeah.
We set up a special room that nobody could go in. We just kind of push the shoes in. There would be one person that trained to run this new machine, and they were testing out the machines. And we would test out the machine for them. And it would be completely secret and all that, and it would be only the few employees who were in there working on that machine would know anything about it. They'd come out, get the shoes, go in and perform with them and go out, but there was testing that machinery. But all that was just taking place, you see, in the late 50s and the early 60s as we started. There was this big change to it. New inventions in the shoe industry, which they had not been.
You were all on the block.
Right, yeah, absolutely. And so that's what happened. So when you
started, was there a lot of competition in Lustenabin as far as, were there a lot of other shoe shops?
Yeah, there were a lot. There were quite a few shoe shops, as a matter of fact.
And that didn't bother you?
Well, it bothered me. I was just a little, I was 26.
You didn't know
I was 26 years old, you know, and they didn't want to talk to me for all of the in China, but they had a local shoe union at the time, and it had to be a joke on both sides. It really, it probably was, and they would, I guess they'd negotiate the rates, but the shoe union had an attorney, and those factories had an attorney, and the two lawyers would get together and decide what the gosh darn increase was going to be. I was amazed. I mean, I went in there, I sat in the meeting. We weren't a part of that, but I wanted to know what was going on, so I went to the employers meeting. But our employees weren't involved in the union, and their lawyer was telling them what the deal was going to be. And I sat there saying, this is crazy. You know, it's not that, what should we do and all. No, the lawyer came and told him what they were gonna give. He'd already talked to the other lawyer.
And it was all set.
It was all set. It was set up by the two lawyers. I said, boy, this is crazy. But that's the way it was.
Did your company ever have a union?
No, we did not. No, we
did not. Did they try to unionize,
yeah,
or did you?
You know, I think they did. What happened was, as my parents' factory in Massachusetts started to go down, they made men's shoes, and we only made boys' shoes at the time. They hand sewns became big, and so we started for them a small hand sewn factory for them that we oversaw, but they had their own person. Hand sewer in charge of the hand sew. But that end of the business ended up growing more rapidly than we wanted to worry about. So finally we said, wait a minute, you guys worry about this thing. We'll set you up on the other side of the building, and we said, get your own management and all that kind of thing, you know. And so they did. And they did have some labor problems with that company. And so I got involved a little bit at that time just to help them out, but also when the union was trying to organize their factory in those old mill buildings, you had the same stairways. Everybody's coming up and down the same stairways, you know. So if they handed out the flyers and the things, they're also handing them out for our people and all that. So that's the only one I think I can remember, Roger. Can you remember any other?
No.
That was the only one that I can remember. It really didn't have anything to do with us, but we weren't sure. At that particular time, but it had to do with them.
So you never had any, had to deal with any strikes by your employees?
Oh, yeah. Yes, we did.
You did?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, we
can
did.
You talk
yeah,
about
we
that?
Did. Yeah,
or?
We did. Yeah, I can tell you about that one.
About that one? You're talking
yeah,
about
yeah.
you had one strike?
Yeah, we had one. We had one. We had one, yeah, right. Well, first I'll tell you a funny one, because which before I tell you that one, we thought we had a strike. Okay? We thought we had a wildcat strike. And what it was is in the morning, Bruce had gone down to our lasting department, and the quality wasn't good. And so, well, Bruce was a bull, you know, and he'd get down and he raised hell. So that was in the morning, and I think it was a Friday or something. I can't remember when it was. And then all of a sudden, at 12:45, well, lunch was what, half an hour, was it, Roger?
12:30.
There's nobody in the last year. Oh my gosh, we've got a wildcat strike on our hands. Gosh, if I talk to Bruce, gee, maybe I was too rough on him or something. But then somebody came 5 minutes later and said, hey, there's a lot of voices in the elevator. The elevator's stuck. And we went down, and sure enough, the whole last year had gone out. They'd gone out and had a beer at lunchtime across the street at the Pastime Club. And the elevator got stuck, and they were all stuck in the elevator. So we really didn't have a strike at all. They got stuck. That was the only reason. But they were happened to be together.
That was before my time.
Yeah, but they happened to be yeah. all together anyway because they had gone out.
So here's another connection to the French Canadians.
Pastime was important. Anyway.
Okay, that was the funny strike.
The actual strike that we had. I have some old newspaper articles. Was during the we had a wage and price freeze. I wish I could remember the time. But we had a wage freeze. It was a freeze on wages and prices. It was price controls and wage controls. And the way they instituted it was that there was a certain percentage that of your wages that you could increase, total wages, okay? And I can't remember what the percentage is today, but it was, let's just say it was 8% at that particular time. It was during the high wage period, and they were trying to bring down the inflation. And it didn't mean that you couldn't give that person 10%. The only problem is you had to give that person 6% to make up for it, because you could only do 8% in total. Okay, so that was the whole thing. And we had decided that now we're in this thing together, we're going to have to pretty much give everybody the whatever the rate is, and that's the end of it. And we had some cutters who wanted more. Well, I said, the only way you can get more is we got to give less to everybody else. We're not going to do that. And so I think we had 10 cutters at the time, and they walked out. And he said, I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. And we're not going to change that. And we kind of felt that politically, probably was the best thing anyway, because we knew that we did feel that the rest of the factory is going to look at those guys and say, you guys got to be nuts. You know, you want more, so I get less. You know, they truly understand the situation. And what happened was, I said, hey, that's it. And one of the things when we did set up the factory is that I would say between Bruce and I, we can do just about every job in that factory. I had been trained as a boy. I worked in the shoe factory. So I went back cutting shoes. Several of them decided no, it was the wrong thing, and they came back.
We had some outside cutters
to get through the period, and then we trained our own cutters, and we trained all a new batch of cutters. But I'd say out of the 10, three or four maybe?
Three that I can remember.
I can't remember.
They came back.
Three or four came back. we wouldn't take a couple back. Our foreman, he cut, I cut, and we had other outside cutters who we contracted with to get through the period, and that was it.
And that was the only strike you had? That's the only problem you've ever had?
Yeah, that's the only one that we had.
So your workers seem to be pretty satisfied then?
I would hope so. Everybody always questions about that job.
Did your employees, whether they were management or just the lowly worker or the guy in the middle, did they all have an opportunity to participate in suggestions or how to make things better?
Roger probably can answer that one better than I can. We did try. I have to say this, that we did try to move with the times. At the beginning, it was a very dictatorial system. There's no doubt about that. But I think we did try to move with the times and get people to take responsibility for their jobs and to get their input into things. We did have teams in the end and trying to do team projects, and we brought people from the floor to even be the team leaders to do some of the projects and design some of the things we did. I'll be honest with you, Rachel, those types of projects take a lot longer to do that way than the old dictatorial system of, let's go do it.
Let's do it.
Yeah. And at times you wonder whether is this really worth it? But I think it is in the long run, it was tough sometimes, wasn't it? We struggled.
But overall, I was kind of disappointed after I left. And after you left, they reverted back, to the old methods in the certain departments that we had. But, if you wanted to make it work, you could make it work. And we did.
Let me ask you about, they talk about industry really ruined the Androscoggin River and whatnot. Did the shoe industry have any part in that? Was there anything that you guys had to do to discharge in the rivers, or were there dyes or things that you had to use that?
No. Fortunately, our industry, we did use some solvents and glues and things like that in the factory, which we had to be very careful about. And by that time, we had safe rooms and all that kind of business, which we built, and Bob Roy built. He took over those mills, and he really helped that town by taking over those mills. There was no doubt about it. I think we always tried to do the right thing as soon as we knew that, wait a minute, there's containment methods and things like that for these flammable chemicals. We're gonna do it. Well, we had some of the old shoe dogs in our building, some of the old people who've been in the business for a long time. They didn't want to spend a nickel. And so Bob, because of insurance for his building, he said, heck with it, I'm going to build it for everybody. I'm going to build one on every floor and charge you for it if you don't do it yourself. Well, we'd already done it, so it didn't make any difference. But that's what he did. And the heck with him. He wasn't going to have somebody ruining his rate, too, because they're not doing what they should do. So he was a tough old buzzard, but he did it right.
In the French-Canadian families, we noticed a lot of what was happening was the man would come home and bring the paycheck and give it to the wife, and she would take care of the budget and the family and the household things and everything. Do you have any inkling as to whether it was like that in the shoe industry also?
Oh, yeah. And Roger, did you tell the story, or shall I tell
it? No, I didn't tell the story.
I've got to tell the story because this is very indicative of that. One of the things, Rachel, I did believe in, that a company, its success should be shared by its workers, its owners, its customers, and its community. I was a strong believer in that.
Yes, you were.
And so we had instilled a profit sharing plan early on, which was
which has led to the 401k plans. But it was way before they had 401k plans and all that kind of business. We had it a long time ago. And so this basically was the profit from the company went to the employees and a certain percentage. And then we came along and I wanted to up that percentage, but the problem was that I didn't want to be paternalistic in that, and talking with Roger was really handling our human relations at the time. And in my conversations with Roger, wait a minute, you've got some young people who really need the money now. You've got other people who are getting close to retirement and they want the money for retirement. So if you're going to up the percentage of that you're going to pay in the profit sharing plan, let's devise something that would work for both. And so what we did was said, okay, I think in this case it was 10% of the profit. This was the additional, because we were already paying out, I think 15% of the profit is now another 10. And so what we decided to do is, we're going to pay this 10% out, and we're going to pay it on a quarterly basis in cash. But at the same time, we're going to set up the 401k plans that now come into being. They had just started. We're going to set up a 401k plan, because we already had the other profit sharing plan going on, so that you're going to get this money, but if you are at the age where you're worried about retirement, you can put it into the 401k plan and not pay taxes on it right now. But if you're young and you need it for family, you take it. Okay, fine. So that seemed to solve the problem that I had with being this paternalistic, let them make the decision. So Roger went around and talked to everybody, and I think we had a very high percentage of people who had decided to put the money in their 401k plan. Am I correct?
Right, that's correct.
Yeah, very high percentage. But some people didn't. Now remember, this is a quarterly check, right, that we were going to do this on a quarterly basis. And what it was is you signed up for a year, and then you could change your election the next year. And so after the first year, all of a sudden, a large amount of people changed their election from the 401k plan to get the money
right away.
And I was bothered by that, so I asked Roger about it. He said, well, no, he said, I'll find out. So he went out to find out and talk to people. Right, he came back, and he said, what it was that people found out that the quarterly check came as a separate check. It didn't come as an addition to one of your weekly checks. So coming as a quarterly check, your spouse would not know that this thing is coming. So therefore, when you got the check, this was your mad money.
Oh my goodness.
Okay?
You're kidding me.
Right. And so what they found out was that's the way the check was being sent to these other people. So, gee, that sounds like a great idea. My husband or wife won't know about it, and I have that extra check for myself.
And what was surprising most to me was the fact that there was as many women that wanted to stash that as there were men.
Yeah, okay. So that answers you. That was a long way around to answering your question.
That goes
but it
to
was
show.
Very telling as to what it was.
Yeah.
You know, the weekly check, that goes home. Everybody knows what we make. But this was an extra. Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah.
Well, that gives a pretty good overview. Is there something that you can think of that you haven't talked about that would be important? I know you're being part of the community, to me, was very important because you were a very giving man and very, you made sure you were part of the community. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I guess the only other thing.
You seem to try to stay involved,
Well, I think the only other thing is that my thoughts really were I'm so concerned that I think our industry should take care of those constituents that I mentioned, and that the profits of our industry should go to those constituents. And so even in our gifts, and Falcon we did give the maximum allowed by IRS, and we gave it to the Lewiston Auburn area because we said we're giving for our employees in this area. And believe me, all of our customers would hit us, give to you know, this thing in New York City, or this in Orlando, and we were able to say that, you know, no, we give it to our local community. So we did kind of quietly, you know, participate in a lot of organizations in the community, but that was just because of my belief, you know.
And it was appreciated,
yeah.
Too. A lot of people still remember
yeah.
it.
Well, hopefully it's good.
Yeah, they do.
...5 years. And they made a lot of money. Now there's a whole nother group of those same type of people that are back in there. And in the first year, the board of directors paid a dividend equal to the investment that those people had made in the company. And Iron Age ended up with very little cash. And from that moment on, they never could catch up. And it was, in my mind, it didn't have to happen.
That's interesting.
It was a financial thing that just absolutely ruined the company.
That's almost like what we've learned from the textile industry,
mm-hmm.
like Bates Manufacturing, where they were bought out and then bought out
yeah.
again, and then they
second
were left
one
with
was
no
the one
cash.
That did, right, absolutely, that's
and
what happened.
And that's when the employees bought it, but
yep.
by then it was too late because they were
right.
straddled with so much debt and
yep.
no cash that
yep.
they couldn't hang on.
They couldn't make it. And, well, see, what it is each one of those investors put in, into Iron Age, put in $10 million. $1 million went into stock, and $9 million went into bonds. And those bonds were 12% bonds. So you get 12% on $9 million. Your investment was $10 million. Well, you know, 12% on nine is what? I mean, 12 times 9 is 108. So what you got was a 10.8% investment on $10 million. Do you follow me? But that $1 million for the first group now, that $1 million grew. That each one of those first group. That $1 million grew to 10. So the first group got, in addition to getting 12% on $9 million for 5 years, they got $10 million on the one. So they made a bundle, right? And that's exactly what happened to the next group. They bought it, but then they lost it. Okay. And what they did was, because I happened to be there when that second sale went through. Iron Age had a plan, and the reason why it was an excellent company was the way they grew. And what they had was they had trucks that went to General Motors. They had trucks that went to Bath Iron Works and all that. And those trucks were loaded with shoes. And when you opened the back door of the truck, they put a ladder down, and you came in. And the first 2 feet were like two chairs like this that were fitting chairs. And then there were swinging doors, and the rest of the truck was like a warehouse. So they would go right to the factory. They'd go to Bath Iron Works,
mm-hmm.
and the Bath Iron Works employee would come up, and on the wall they had the pictures of, they had the a sample of the boot, and the person said, I want that one. They say, good, what size do you sit down? They go into the truck, pull it up, fit it, oh yeah, there you go, you got. And now that's Joe Blow, clock number such and such, and they'd charge Bath Iron Works for it. And Bath Iron Works let Iron Age do the paperwork, and so it worked great. Well, if you understand then, they had a warehouse in Portland. Now, from Portland, they can do Bath Iron Works, they can do all, they can do the paper mills, they can do everything around this thing. So they would have one salesman who would sell. And by the way, the place, it happens to be in Westbrook, they had a store. So in those days, they had the paper mill in Westbrook. Those people went to the store, and other small businesses in Portland would go to the store to be fitted, but their company paid the freight. And so what would happen is that salesman would get maxed out, and as they say, the guy starts playing a little golf, because the truck can only go, you know, if the truck is busy every day of the year doing this business, which they figured maximum was one of those stores would do maybe $1.75 million. Well, what they would do was say, okay, I've got a store in Portland, and I've got another one, we'll say in around Boston. And they'd say, oh, both of them are maxed out. The salesman isn't working. All right, good. We're going to set up a new one. We're going to set it in Manchester, New Hampshire. And what they would do, they'd take some of the customers from Portland, who may be down in Sanford, and say, well, we'll service you out of this now Manchester operation. And we'd take some north of Boston that might be up in Lawrence or Lowell, and we'll try, and okay. So they would start Manchester with maybe $500,000 worth of business. But they've taken $250,000 here and $250,000 here. Now these guys have to get off the golf course and start selling again. And this outfit, when they open the door, it's profitable right away. Because it starts with 500. Because the guy in Sanford, all he knows is an Iron Age truck comes. He doesn't care whether it comes from Portland or whether that thing comes from Manchester. And they set up 10 of those operations per year, every year. So Manchester would slowly grow from $500,000, and it would slowly grow up to $1.75 million. Meanwhile, Portland slowly gets back up again, and so does in Boston. And they put 10 new centers around every year. Now, those centers cost money because you have to, it's a special truck. You have to have a warehouse, you have to have inventory, right? Now, that's an investment every year that they make. But they've got built-in growth for the next 10 years. Okay, well, 2 years before they sold, the old management, well, not the old manager, but the old director said, we're going to stop putting in these new things because we're not going to make this $10 million investment for the next 2 years because we're preparing this place to sell. Well, what they're doing is they're cutting down the growth that's going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there's ways to do that. And I saw that happening when my last year and I was there. I knew exactly what was going to happen. There was nothing I could do. You know what I mean? Because I'm not a director of the company. I'm just an employee.
Yeah.
But I said, oh boy, I can see this happening.
Let me, in the same, kind of like in the same vein, you talked about foreign competition.
Yeah.
In talking to the workers and to the oral histories that we did in the textile mills, it seemed like they were all, most people say, well, the textile mills closed because of foreign competition. Some managers say that it wasn't all the fault of foreign competition, that the mills themselves did not try to keep up and upgrade their machinery and their equipment enough to be able to keep up with the foreign competition. Is there a little bit of that happened?
There's a lot of that in the shoe industry.
Okay.
I mean, I would say that's the reason why Falcon survived, because we were the last of Mohegans, but we did put all of our money back into the machinery. Okay, we did put our money back into the machinery. That's why it still survives to this day, although it might be questionable where it goes from here. But and the people who left, that was exactly what I said about them, was, my gosh, they're not keeping up. But the problem is that even in the end, the differences were too great.
Yeah.
And so we had to specialize. And if you specialize, I felt we could probably survive. And I think, you know, they could, but there'd be less people. You're not gonna have 225 doing the specialty work.
Yeah. You said that you went and you studied what they did in China.
Yeah.
and the costs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
What were they doing so different? Is it just the cost of labor that gives them the big advantage?
Yes,
or what?
Yeah.
So
well,
the cost
the problem
of
is it's the cost of labor, but it's also, well and you see, that's it. The
so
footwear
what,
industry.
What makes it that they can do it so inexpensively versus what we're doing?
Footwear is very labor intensive.
Right.
Okay. When we get through, we basically, I think 27 or 28% of our costs were all direct labor. That's direct labor, the people in the factory. That's not even the supervisor, such as Roger or someone like myself or the sales. And so the higher the percentage of labor in your product, of course, that's the part they can squeeze. And they do. And so it's not only just the direct labor, but it was also their supervisors and things like that. Took a heck of a lot less. And so that's really where, you know, where it started. And when you're now dealing with a product we sell for $40, you know, over 10 of it is labor. And their costs were less than a tenth of ours.
Okay.
So now you're dealing with a lot of money, and,
yeah,
and a big amount of money. And what we discovered through the Dunham brand, when we owned the Dunham brand, that was interesting, in that in the, I guess it was early 90s, 1900s, 1990s, we stressed that we were U.S. made. And we had the yellow boots, you know, the yellow boots,
yeah,
like you think of a Timberland boot and all that kind of thing. We made those and sold those. And Dunham was actually the first one to make that boot, by the way. And we knew that we could get the sale at the retail level as long as we were within $10 of an import from China. Now, that was back then. I think right now that probably isn't the case. I think people now accept Chinese footwear better than they did back then. But that was the magic number. As long as we could stay within $10 at retail, we were okay. And when we had to go to $15 at retail more than shoes made in China imported, then that's when we saw the nosedive on those,
yeah,
stock numbers like crazy. So it was kind of like a magic number that the Americans would pay an extra 10, but that was it.
Yeah.
You know.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Ted, could you talk a little bit about our flexibility, you know, where we started with kids' shoes and how,
yeah,
we converted from,
yeah,
one to the other? What was the cause of those conversions? I mean,
yeah,
what happened then? You had to do these drastic changes,
well,
overnight.
Any business, you know, it's funny. I mean, there is a thing. And they call it the sigmoid curve, and it's an S curve. And when you get to the top, every time you have to almost reinvent yourself.
Yeah.
And I believe that now. Not that I really believed it then, but I believe it now because there were two major things in the 35 years that we had that were very major in the survival of that company where we hit those curves. And one was we were making just boy shoes, but we were making boy shoes for, at the time, the discounters were big. Now, I say the discounters, they were, I'm trying to think of who we have in Lewiston. Oh, golly. Was it not Fields? It's the shopping center where Sears is now, that there was a building now the other part of that shopping, it's the other part of that shopping center, but there was a discount store there, big brand, I can't remember who it was, but they were big, and unfortunately the footwear that was sold in those discount places were specific footwear houses that you might go to a Zayers, but Zayers didn't run the shoe department. This company called Morse ran the shoe departments in Zayers.
Oh.
That type of thing. And so it was that type of a Zayers store, okay, which they were big in the United States. They were the first big discounters. They were big all through the United States, all of those types of them. Mammoth Mart and
Ames.
Ames
was
another one, right? All
Sears.
Those, right? Yeah, those. There was those types of stores. There were, and we, our boy shoes sold in those stores, because we were less expensive than everybody else, but the quality was great. And actually, even Jimmy Wellahan used our shoes. He would sell the big brand of Stride Right, which was the kids' brand, and then he would use our brand as the house brand. We even sold a Stride Right and buy our shoes, but I mean, so you could also buy them in Zayers. So that would tell you really where we were. But the major volume was in those discount stores. But we also sold people like Jimmy Wellahan. And what happened was leather prices rose rapidly, and those stores didn't want to go up in price to follow the leather market. So they wanted us to make vinyl shoes and whatnot. For them, because they wanted to keep us as a supplier. One of the big fortes was we did what we said we were going to do, and that's big. And so we decided at that point, no, we're going to go with the quality, and we will find our own markets, upscale markets. And so we left them all within 1 year and redid our markets and went after the better grade markets. And at that time, that was a big thing as to whether we would survive. And we did. And we were able to get into those markets and get into the top quality shoes. Then what happened was our idea was that we would go to Jimmy Wellahan and say, you know, of all your businesses, the women's shoes are 55% of your business, men's are another 35% of it, girls are the small percentage, and boys are even the smallest percentage you got, you know, 2 or 3%. So spend all your time worrying about your women's and men's business, and we'll take care of your boys' business for you. We will be the ones who will go out. It was a fashion business in those days, because little boys wanted to, that was the teenage years when everybody wanted to follow their big brother and all that. And so we said, every year we'll research the market. We will come out with the styles that you need, you know, for to handle the boys' business. And so that's exactly what we did. We researched the world. We did all these products. We built new products. Every year was all new products. And we would go to that customer like Jimmy Wellahan, and here's what you need, you know. And we would give you maybe two or three different choices, and you could choose them depending upon your area. But we had studied and knew what would go in the Northeast, what went in the South, what went in the West, out of California, all that kind of business. And we did that, and that's what we did for people. Well, then athletic footwear, we could see that happening. And as athletic footwear started to happen, we realized, this is a problem. Because athletic shoes, I don't know if you remember them, they had all kinds of swishers on them and all kinds of stuff. And we were concerned as to whether we were going to be able to compete, because now the Chinese were coming in, actually it was Taiwan in those days, and with that. And so fortunately, we were working with United Shoe Company developing the computer controlled sewing machine. And that was back in the early 70s, it was the early 70s. And we saw the computer-controlled sewing machine as the one way that we could put all these parts together and be able to compete with the Chinese, which we did. And that's how we ended up developing that technology with United Shoe Machinery and came up with that. But even as we went along with that, okay, now we can compete with them. One thing I saw was that the kids, I saw in several places that if an adult brand put in a kid's shoe, that the kids wanted the adult brand, no matter what they had to pay for it. And I realized that was going to happen. And that's exactly what happened in athletic shoes, that the kids wanted the Nikes and all that. And you could see. And the athletic part of the boys' business was just growing like crazy, and I could see that was going to end up with the adult brands that wanted to come down and make little kids' shoes. And when that happened, we knew we had to get out of the little kids' business. And so that's when we, knowing we were good technical specialists, we got into polyurethane, which was another technology, and we started pushing that because we saw the opportunity to make men's boots using this high-tech material that nobody wanted to touch, because it was such a at the time it was a chemical process, and so we talked the developers of this process, which is an English company, we talked them into giving us a machine for nothing, and that we would do these projects for people as a demonstration project. And we said we know the people to go make this project happen. Well, this product happened, and that was Timberland. We'll make these shoes for Timberland, and when they finally hire success at it, then they'll have to buy the machinery. So you give us the machine, let us be the machine dealer, and we'll sell the product that way. And that's exactly what happened. Those machines were worth $1 million apiece. We couldn't afford that for all of in China, but we've got to give it to them. And in the end, we bought them. We ended up with three of them. But very first one we got given. So that got us into the men's business and the men's technical shoe business, which we felt was the only way we were going to go. And as we made those major shifts, the problem was then, as I told you, that the big volume items are going. You're going to make these high technical products. That means that your people had to have multiple skills so they could move from job to job and all that. And we really spent a lot of time. That was part of our education process and all that, was to cross-train so people could do many jobs. And so that we could do this diversity that we knew was the only way we were going to have to survive in the business. And that was a big part of it.
In your experience as being a manufacturer, because I guess your family, your family was in it too, and everything.
My grandfather came over as a shoemaker from Sweden.
From Sweden.
Yeah.
Okay. When you look at America today with all the manufacturing processes going overseas, where do you feel that, in your opinion, where do you feel that's going to leave America?
Well, it just scared the heck out of me back in those days. You know, when we were going through it.
Yeah.
And I can remember that I was concerned when I was presenting the shoe case to the government in Washington. If you ever had to present anything to the Senate groups or something like that, it reminds me of the Inquisition. You sit here, and believe me, when you've seen the TVs, they're elevated. You know, they're not on the same plane. Those senators and the representatives are elevated. They're up. So you're looking up at them. I mean, it's a very intimidating thing, that room and that chamber that they're in. You see it on TV,
right. But
believe me, you know, you have to be there. You're looking up like this, man. You know, it's intimidating. But I can remember saying, you know, what are we going to do? We have these skilled people. But, you know, they didn't study computers back in school. And I'm talking about the people who were 40 and 50 years old in those days. You know, they've got another 25 years of work. And, you know, they're not going to be computer geniuses. They're not all going to, you know, go... you know, work for Microsoft and all that kind of business, you know, which is the talk of the time. But we've got to think about what we're going to do with those people. And I am concerned. And I do think that that's the reason why what's happened is this wage level thing is you've got this diversity. You've got this diversity of income, high, low, you know, and it's just bothered the daylights out of me because I saw it. I saw manufacturing, which are the good jobs where people have get experience to learn, and so therefore you can pay for it. Those are the jobs that have disappeared. It really bothers me. It really does, yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else that you can think of? What was the highlight of your career in the shoe industry in Los Tanabe?
I don't know. There's a highlight. There's an awful lot of good times. You know, the factory gave me a surprise party. I have to say
the parties that Falcon did for the employees too. I mean, we celebrated everything and anything.
Yeah.
You know, that was Falcon's theory that, hey, there's a reason for a party, let's party. Our biggest one was probably our 25th anniversary.
That was fun.
We celebrated that for a full year. Every week we would have drawings for all kinds of gifts. I mean, you name it, vacations.
That was great.
For every week during the course of that year, at the end, on the bash day, the 25th anniversary, it was added as well. You know, I've yet to have that video. Cookie had that video.
Oh, really?
And that will be part of
the archives as well.
Yeah, no, we
Well, you know, it's
great.
Funny because it's you're talking about this type of thing, and you always hear that the textile workers and the shoe workers, they were overworked, and it was dirty work, and it was this and it was that. And yet, when I had the mill workers reunion, and we tried to get the people to come back, which we're going to have a shoe workers reunion, by the way, next spring. Mm-hmm. We weren't sure whether we were going to get kicked in the shins or hugged because, you know, we heard all these things. And yet, when the people came into the mills, they'd come in and they'd walk on the floor and they'd go, oh, I'm home.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, this was my piece of equipment. And they'd pet it as if it was like a, you know, in big tears. And I worked on this for 40 years. Yeah. This was my machine. It was like the pride they had in the...
Well, each machine had a personality, too. I mean, you had a quirk. I mean, you worked on a machine, so you know what? Yeah. You have a machine, and man, you worked on the other guy's machine. It was different.
It was different.
There was something different about it. Whatever it is, they had a personality. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was amazing to see how they weren't talking about the dirty lint and the noise and hot and whatnot. They were talking about they had a job and they raised their families and they were proud to be working, and you know, it was beautiful.
What it is we produce something. You know, and as I always said, I was proud to work in the shoe industry. Because we ended up, if you really think about it, we took an offal, which is hide. They don't slaughter the animal for the hide, they slaughter it for the meat. That's 5% of the darn thing. It's awful. And we turned around and made it something useful. And that was fun. And to know when you get through, we produced this thing from something that we're going to throw away. And so there's a pride in that.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not so sure that in the service industry, unfortunately, that you can have that pride. You know,
Rendering a service is not producing something.
It's not producing the same. You had a physical thing, you know. You put your hands on the gosh damn thing. I loved working with leather, man. That was exciting. That was fun. The leather made the business fun because it was unique.
The leather making business?
No, just using leather. The tannery business. Oh, that's a different story. That was quite a business too. That means you talk about, with her first question, about the drainage and all that kind of stuff, pollution and all that kind of business with that industry. That was their problem. Yeah.
Well, that's good. I think we've got can you think of anything that we've left out?
No,
have we covered pretty much?
I still have my bag.
Yeah,
my cloth bag with the silver dollars.
Yeah, you sold it at the yard sale. The kids sold it. You got it back.
Yeah.
Bought it for you.
Oh, yeah. No, but I'm saying, the velvet bag.
Oh,
the
yes.
The blue velvet bag.
We celebrated our 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
Where all employees were given a velvet bag tied with a little white ribbon with your name and the amount of years that you were employed. Every employee received 25 Susan B. Anthony dollars for the 25th anniversary, plus $1 for each year of employment. So I have my little purple bag with $34.
The goddamn things weighed a ton. Well, that many silver dollars, they were...
We'll have to find somebody that is willing to, that still has it, willing to part with it. Those are part of the things that make the story puts the human in the stories.
I still have mine.
Have you
here?
Oh,
yeah.
I have mine. Ariel Lazarus.
I was going to say, that's the other thing that I was going to say. If people clean out and whatnot, don't throw anything away, Ted.
I wish I...
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately,
when
I moved to the island, I did move out a lot of things, which is too bad because I did have a lot of things.